Thank you, David. Elder Sorensen and his wife will leave within about a month for Hong Kong on a 3-year tour there. They'll see some interesting history as Hong Kong prepares to become a part of the People's Republic of China. And I thank David and Verla for their presence here tonight and for that introduction. One would have to be intellectually inert and emotionally deprived not to be touched by the proceedings this evening. With you, I've been so grateful for what's been said and what's been sung, for the wonderful orchestral and choral arrangements. I want to thank the sponsors of the Freedom Festival and all the leaders who do so much to make this possible, and likewise to express my appreciation to the honorees. It's interesting, isn't it, as we listen to their deserved awards, we heard names like Croatia, Somalia, Berlin, and of course, all of Eastern Europe. We're in a time, ladies and gentlemen, when America has truly fallen into history, and our journey there is inescapable, and it is drenched with significance. Usually, and rightfully, we celebrate that dimension of patriotism which honors Americans who have fought militarily in defense of our freedoms, even going abroad to rescue the unfree and to make safe the distant shore. Being privileged almost within the month to visit the 122-acre cemetery in France overlooking Omaha Beach, with its 9,300 sobering graves, was a very moving experience. Families strolled the peaceful Omaha beach that day. Gulls looped and swooped down in serene flight. What a contrast to the thundering sounds of intense battle on that same beach and its overlooking bluffs, where next June it will be 50 years since D-Day and Normandy. What an unselfish thing it was for so many to give their lives so far from home and in behalf of so many others whom they never even knew, but who nevertheless yearned for freedom. Earlier, there have been for me tender and sobering visits back to Okinawa, where I participated briefly in that World War II campaign and heard firsthand what General MacArthur eloquently called the strange, mournful mutter of the battlefield. For me, therefore, this traditional dimension of patriotism is particularly and understandably touching and impressive. Yet it is only one important dimension of patriotism, for there are other needs of patriotism which beckon us, as we've seen in our honorees tonight. I will make no attempt tonight to exaggerate the virtues of America's past, nor to exaggerate the flaws of its present. Even so, reflecting on that special patriotic hymn we just heard played and sung, America the Beautiful, provides so much for us to ponder. Given America's present circumstances, certain of that hymn's lyric phrases are actually quite haunting. As we sing, for instance, of a patriot dream that sees beyond the years, it reminds us of the special perspective which patriotism possesses. True patriotism takes the long view of this nation's needs. For instance, what does this reminding lyric tell us about our constant and collective refusal, regardless of party, to face America's mounting national debt and our destabilizing budget deficits? The national debt increases $1 billion every 24 hours. Or in other words, during the few minutes I occupy this pulpit, America's national debt will grow about $700,000 per minute and approximately $21 million. By this persistent lack of national resolve in our time, we are robbing our children and grandchildren, however silently, of their economic freedom and future. We cannot seem to see beyond the political moment, let alone beyond the years. Indeed, the patriot's dream may be replaced by some nightmares. So it is that whenever we talk about patriotism, the risks are that we will define it too narrowly. It's not that any particular dimension of patriotism is unworthy. Rather, no one portion of patriotism comprises the whole of patriotism. For instance, we would all quickly agree that patriotism is more than paying taxes. It is likewise more than voting. Yet it includes these, along with all the other unglamorous chores of citizenship. Patriotism requires public perspiration, as well as an educated public who truly can see beyond the years. Besides, the perspective of patriotism is vital because democracy and memory are not automatic partners. Tocqueville observed of America, "Not only does democracy make every man forget his ancestors, but it hides his descendants and separates his contemporaries from him. It throws him back forever upon himself alone and threatens in the end to confine him entirely within the solitude of his own heart." Such loneliness, ladies and gentlemen, increases selfishness. By contrast, James Wilson, one of our founding fathers, urged the delegates to the Constitutional Convention of 1787 to look beyond their own time and constituencies to the needs of generations yet unborn. They did it, and all succeeding generations were blessed. Patriotism, which sees beyond the years, leaves legacies to rising generations instead of debt. It leaves a clean turf, not the debris of a selfish society. Tolkien wisely counseled, saying, "It is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. What weather they shall have is not ours to rule." How are we doing, ladies and gentlemen, with those years wherein we are set? As we sing the words, "Confirm thy soul in self-control," what of our society's increasing lack of impulse control? So many people act out their impulses in so many inappropriate and destructive ways, including the neglect of families and children. More than we realize, our whole society really rests on the capacity of its citizens to give what is called obedience to the unenforceable. We do this by complying willingly with the law and behaving voluntarily according to time-tested standards. Such citizenship expresses a high form of volunteerism. In contrast, widespread and sustained lack of self-control will bring either severe external controls or anarchy. America's founders were determined to avoid both of those awful alternatives. The lack of self-control collectively and individually adds to our debt, to America's devastating drug problem, and to our growing crime. The quality of self-control is best grown in healthy family gardens, yet so many families are failing. Healthy families are the first places in which we learn how to balance rights and responsibilities and to take turns. In America the Beautiful, we also sing about establishing a thoroughfare of freedom. But many of our streets, instead of being a thoroughfare of freedom, are unsafe. Ironically, drugs and pornography often have staked out their well-worn thoroughfares or corridors and free zones. Surely it is one of the first duties of government to protect its citizens. Nevertheless, however beefed up, law enforcement cannot realistically be expected to compensate fully for a widespread lack of individual self-control. We rightly sing about a good America and how it should be crowned with brotherhood. Instead of increasing brotherhood, there is increasing separatism in America. There is even rising racism. There is also a decrease in the respect among our citizens for each other. Engulfing gangs almost daily remind us of failing families and neighborhoods. We sing, too, about how our alabaster cities gleam, undimmed by human tears. Our cities don't gleam. Many are decaying, covered with graffiti. They are dimmed with human tears of desperation by those who feel left out of the American dream. The challenges of urban decay actually threaten to overwhelm America. Thomas Jefferson was especially far-seeing when he said that once people were piled on top of people in America, as they were then in Europe, America would have very serious problems. We do. Surely, therefore, we much need the wise expressions of patriotism which will improve the quality of life in our decaying cities. In that same marvelous hymn, we plead for God to mend America's every flaw. But can we both acknowledge our flaws productively and believe in the mender? God's blessings will depend upon our behavior. We can be free from bondage and captivity if we serve God. Being worthy, therefore, of America's past and deserving God's blessings in the future are vital, but not only for America. More hinges on what happens in America than we realize. It was so in the beginning, as the Declaration of Independence became one of the special acts in all of human history. It affected not only the people of America, but it spurred much of mankind. In a less attended to address in Independence Hall, February 1861, Abraham Lincoln said, "I have often pondered over the dangers which were incurred by the men who assembled here and framed and adopted that declaration. I have pondered over the toils that were endured by the officers and soldiers of the army who achieved that independence. I have often inquired of myself," said Lincoln, "what great principle or idea it was that kept this Confederacy so long together. It was not the mere matter of separation of the colonies from the motherland, but that sentiment in the Declaration of Independence, which gave liberty not alone to the people of this country, but hope to all the world for future time. It was that," said Lincoln, "that in due time the weights would be lifted from the shoulders of all men, and that all should have an equal chance. This," he said, "is the sentiment embodied in the Declaration of Independence." America, with all of its problems, is still a beacon. This beacon needs to shine more brightly today for the sake of all mankind in order to continue to give, in Lincoln's words, hope to all the world. Whatever the dimension of patriotism, therefore, it requires that America have and maintain a spiritual core in order that our hopes are not in vain. Without this spiritual core, our liberties, our cities, our fiscal policies, and our brotherhood will finally fail and falter. Virtue must, therefore, reside in the people as well as in the leaders. John Adams so cautioned, saying, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Unexciting as a prescription, nevertheless, the best single way to improve the quality of life in America is to improve the quality of our own individual lives and our own neighborhoods. Otherwise, citizen failures to respect property or to practice chastity and fidelity, with all of those consequences, with all of those failures, cannot be corrected by mere legislation. Similarly, our neglect of the poor or of our civic duties cannot be corrected by executive orders. Our inspired Constitution is wisely designed to protect us from excesses of political power, but it can do little to protect us from the excesses of appetite or from individual indifference to great principles or institutions. Any significant unraveling of the moral fiber of the American people, therefore, finally imperils the Constitution. The moral fabric of this society can become dangerously and relentlessly frayed as too few strands strain to hold us together. Hence, having a shared patriotic, spiritual, and moral commitment within this nation's borders is as vital as defending those borders. Therefore, while great leaders are needed, so also are informed and wise followers. John Stuart Mill counseled as follows: a people may prefer free government, but if from indolence or carelessness or cowardice or want of public spirit they are unequal to the exertion necessary for preserving it, if they will not fight for it when it is directly attacked, if they can be deluded by the artifices used to cheat them out of it, if by momentary discouragement or temporary panic or a fit of enthusiasm for an individual, they can be induced to lay their liberties at the feet of even a great man, or trust him with powers which enable him to subvert their institution, in all of these cases they are more or less unfit for liberty. And though it may be for their good to have had it even for a short time, they are unlikely long to enjoy it. Ponder this quotation from Aaron Wildavsky. He observed the interaction between people and their leaders, saying, "Surely it would be surprising if the vices of politicians stemmed from the virtues of the people. What the people do to their leaders must be at least as important as what the leaders do to them." Citizenship and leadership are intertwined. So are individual morality and constitutional viability. So are rights and responsibilities. Our various constitutional freedoms are likewise irrevocably intertwined. Our able and special President Rex Lee has observed of the interplay of certain freedoms the following: like the speech, press, and assembly guarantees, he said, the free exercise of religion clause deals directly with the protection of individual liberties, whereas the Establishment Clause is a structural provision regulating institutional relationships between church and state. Moreover, he said, speech and assembly are central to most religious activity. As I now move to the concluding portions, let us, for a few moments, part the curtains of American history. Doing so will permit us to look at our rich past, to inspire us in our troubled present. This nation had an inspired and breathtakingly close passage in its founding. The initial success in founding this nation was not accidental. It was inspirational. Catherine Drinker Bowen's book about the Constitutional Convention was appropriately called Miracle at Philadelphia. She wrote, "Miracles do not occur at random, nor was the author of this book the one who said there was a miracle at Philadelphia in the year 1787. George Washington said it, and James Madison said it. They used the word in writing to their friends, Washington to Lafayette and Madison to Thomas Jefferson." What happened in Philadelphia in 1787 was a miracle. A more recent historian, Barbara Tuchman, called our founding fathers, quote, "the most remarkable generation of public men in the history of the United States, or perhaps of any other nation," end quote. She said it would be invaluable if we could know what produced this burst of talent from a base of only 2.5 million inhabitants. Some of us here tonight believe there was divine design associated with that burst of talent, involving wise men whom God raised up to this very purpose. One of these, Washington, found his biographer Flexner writing of him these words: "In all history, few men who possessed unassailable power have used that power so gently and self-effacingly for what their best instincts told them was the welfare of their neighbors and all mankind." As one thinks about Washington and power, it reminds us that power is most safe with those like Washington who are not in love with power. The miracle of Constitution writing at Philadelphia was soon followed by a second miracle, less known to the American people. I refer to the miracle of the ratification of the Constitution. The battle raged for about 10 months. Most of the same individuals raised up to write the Constitution also labored to secure its ratification, but not all. Fighting ratification were prestigious and influential patriots like Samuel Adams, who helped start the Revolution, James Winthrop, George Mason, James Monroe, later to be the fifth president, and Patrick Henry. In Pennsylvania, anti-constitutionalists tried to stay away from the ratification meeting in order to prevent the formation of the required quorum for ratification. Finally, two of the recalcitrant anti-federalist assemblymen were dragged in and held in their seats until the business was successfully concluded. It was no picnic in the park. In December, after Pennsylvania ratified the Constitution, a mob attacked James Wilson, the distinguished founding father, and beat him. Rhode Island didn't even ratify until after the new government was functioning. New Hampshire narrowly approved 57-46. Virginia approved by a margin of only 10 votes out of 168. New York approved by the narrowest margin of 30-27. It was a second miracle. Over 200 years have passed since the twin miracles of writing and ratifying the Constitution. Surely, ladies and gentlemen, America has not come thus far only to squander our precious liberties in license or our economic strengths in national indulgence. In a real way, each generation of Americans has its chance to re-ratify the Constitution. We can do this by abiding by its principles and believing our own legacy to posterity. Likewise, by both preserving our constitutional rights, but also fulfilling our responsibilities. Otherwise, expressions of patriotism are no more than verbal veneration without actual emulation. Re-ratification will require statesmanship among both the people and the leaders. Statesmanship differs from politics in that it does not treat symptoms, but strives to cure the underlying diseases. Our founding fathers did statesmanlike work in 1776 and again in 1787. In our time, again, regardless of party, we seem preoccupied with treating symptoms, quick fixes, and with getting by a little longer. Yes, our inspired Constitution has a marvelous system of checks and balances. But if uninspired individuals lack their own checks and balances, the inspired Constitution cannot correct that imbalance. More remedies for our nation's ills are to be found in individual restraint than in restraining orders. More remedies are to be found inside our souls than in our courts, or in families than in legislative bodies. There is more need for neighborly affection than there is for litigation in resolving local disputes. Yes, courts can adjudicate between citizens, but courts cannot supply one citizen with esteem for his fellow citizens. Washington, in his farewell address, counseled, quote, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. the firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and cherish them. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity. Washington knew how to write a constitution. He also knew what it was necessary to have in order to make it survive. Earlier in Washington's inaugural address, his first, he said, "There exists in the economy and course of nature an indissoluble union between virtue and happiness. We ought to be no less persuaded that the propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself ordained." There then happened, after his first inaugural, something that doesn't happen in our time. The Senate replied to Washington's first inaugural, saying, "We feel, sir, and acknowledge the justness of your observations that the foundations of our national policy should be laid in private morality. If individuals be not influenced by moral principles, it is vain to look for public virtue." As I close, may I presume to speak for all of us tonight as if to President Washington on this July 4th night of 1993 and say to him, "We feel, sir, the force and acknowledge the justice of your observations about how the foundations of national policy are to be found in private morality." He knew the American people. He knew our beginnings. He knew our Constitution. We ignore his prescription at our peril. We're surrounded with challenges. I like the spiritual spunk of a Marine general who, on one of those rare occasions, led a group of Marines who were surrounded and embattled. Instead of being discouraged, General Chesty Puller said, "At last, we've got the enemy just where we want him. We can fire in every direction." To you, I say, we are surrounded by challenges, but we can serve in every direction. God bless America and help us mend our every flaw. God bless each and all of you this day and always. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.